Well, good day. I'm Kane. I'm one of the ministers here at St. Hills. If you don't know me, I trained as an actor before I was a minister. Not every day you meet a minister that used to be an actor. Obviously, wasn't a very good actor because now I'm a minister. That had a lot more to do with the Lord calling me into ministry than it did my ability. At least that's what I like to tell myself. But I'm also a father and a husband. I've got two boys. Micah, my eldest, is 3.5, and he's very articulate and verbose, young 3.5-year-old. And my youngest is Tobias. And the other day, he took his first step at 9 months. He's pulling himself up on everything that isn't bolted to the floor, and he's crawling. His favorite thing at the moment is to try to get to the dog's water before I get to the dog's water. And I've been a Christian for about 10 years. That is, I've been a disciple of Jesus for about 10 years. I've actually probably been a Christian most of my life. Now, a lot of us might not draw a distinction between those two things, but as we look at our passage today, we're going to see that actually sometimes there is a distinction between those two things. There is a distinction in the way that the world in particular views us as Christians and whether or not we are or aren't discipling or learning about Jesus from Jesus and how to be more like him. In my 10 years as a Christian, as a disciple, I've spent time in fundamentalist Pentecostal spaces and drank the Kool-Aid. I've spent time in charismatic missions organizations and have traveled to all sorts of places, poor, rich, needy, and not so, and ministered the gospel. Before I even knew what it really meant to minister the gospel. I've spent time in ACC communities with 45-minute worship sets just to start the service and then sermons that can go for an hour and then another hour-long worship set. I've spent time in Baptist congregations and evangelical Anglican communities. And as a kid, I spent many years in Churches of Christ communities and actually still have a bit of affinity for those communities today. And in all that time, and especially in the last 10 years, I've heard talk and tell of this thing that we are living in or entering into or have been in for a long time, a post-Christian era. And depending on which camp you're in, and who you're reading, people will describe that as a really good thing to be hurried along so that the church can get back to core business, like serving the poor and caring for the widows, or a really bad thing that is to be resisted at all costs. Some would take it a step further and actually advocate for almost like a campaigning to get back to a Christian era. Every community seems to date the beginning of this thing differently too, the beginning of the end, as it were. Some would assert that we've only just begun with this generation or maybe the previous, but most people would probably see the signs of this thing coming much sooner than that. And if you're savvy to church history and particularly discipled history, those that really took Jesus seriously and were the remnant in and amongst their culture and community, you can actually see that this has followed the church in cycles for generations since the church has been the church. There is, however, some unique elements to our current manifestation, social media, the rapid news cycle, over-politicized Christianity, and all of those kinds of things, none of which we're really going to delve into today. Needless to say, that most young people that I encounter generally think that an attempt to return back to a Christian era is folly. Not only because it's just not going to happen, at least from where we sit in the cultural perspective now, but actually because there are many things that we can embrace in this new season that we perhaps couldn't in that previous one. What I see in all of you, and I'm talking specifically to youth and young adults, so it might be true for others in the room too, is an embodiment of what James says in chapter 4, verse 4, that friendship with the world is enmity or hatred with God. Young people today, more and more, are living out what it means to come into conflict with the world around them because of their beliefs, because of the things that they hold dear. Or, as I saw it in just about every commentary I looked at in preparing for today, there, this quote by Michael Wilcock, "There is, in truth, no such thing as harmonious coexistence between church and world. For where there is no conflict, it is because the world has taken over." St. Hilary's conflict is an essential part of our message. If we, as the church, as the representatives of Jesus, no, as the bride of Jesus, do not stand in gracious defiance against the thing that our King stands against, then we have rejected our King. If we don't live and teach and champion holy, sexually moral and righteous lives in our leaders and our people and our communities. Notice though that I didn't say demand, enforce, or domineer those things, only hold them up as beautiful alternatives. If we do not look radically different from the world out there, we have rejected our King. And if we do not work with, give to, and advocate for the poor, the voiceless, those suffering genocide and racial oppression, and those fight for those experiencing oppression because of their race, their sex, their gender, their sexuality, their age, or their religion, if we don't embody the spirit of a God that goes down all roads and leads people to himself, notice I didn't say all roads lead to God, only that he goes down all roads to bring his creation back to himself, then, St. Hilary's, we have divorced our divine bridegroom and we have joined ourselves to the spirit of the age. And Judges 13 through 16 tell a story of an Israel that has done exactly that. Utterly unrecognizable from the Philistines around them, of a judge that is impulsive, selfish, and driven entirely by his senses, sexually insatiable, violent, angry, and irreverent. But also of a God in that story that will keep his promises, even if it means directing the evil in Israel and Samson's hearts so that it comes into conflict with the Philistines, with the world around them. God will use Samson in this narrative to create conflict where there is no conflict. And he is going to do this to divorce his people from the spirit of the age, from the communities and the cultures and the gods of the Philistines, and call them back into relationship with himself. Something to pick up here that we didn't press into last week, but we did hear that Samson is a Nazarite. Now, a Nazarite is simply someone who, of the people of God that were set apart for God, they are even more set apart. Someone could take the vow of the Nazarite. You could take this vow, man or woman, And you essentially had three outward conditions that you had to uphold whilst you committed that time to God. Drink no wine or eat fruits of the vine. Don't touch any dead bodies. And don't let any razor touch your face or your head. Don't cut your hair or your beard. And these outward expressions were symbols of the inward commitment to God. But our Nazarite will, by the end of this story, have abandoned every symbol and revealed his impulsive and unteachable heart. And so we're going to pick it up in chapter 14, verse 1. And we hear the narrative play out in 14 that can be loosely summarized by the lady, the lion, and the riddle. Now, I would have loved to have given you another L there, but there actually isn't a great synonym for riddle that begins with L. I could have used labyrinth, but I thought that was just a little bit esoteric for our purposes, so we're going with riddle. In verse 1, we see Samson head to Timnah. Now, this shows us a couple of things. Straight off the bat here, we get a bit of a picture about what's going on. Samson goes to Timnah and he sees a Philistine woman and he wants to make her his wife. Timnah is deep in the heart of Israel's territory. This isn't contested ground on the fringes. This isn't a border town or a fringe territory. This is deep in Israel proper. The enemies of God are nestled deep within the community of God. They are settled, comfortable. They are practicing agriculture. We find out later they have vineyards and crops. This domination is not military, nor is it subjugation, but it's cultural capitulation. This is Israel taking everything good that the culture around them will give them, and all it cost them was their own uniqueness as the people of God. This is cultural capitulation. Again, we talked about last week, Israel doesn't cry out to God for help in this particular cycle of the judges. They seem quite happy with the state of affairs as it is, and we're going to hear a little bit about that into chapter 15 as well. The other thing that we see is that the Samson can come and go from Timnah as he pleases, almost as if this is normal, because it is. Because the people of God and the enemies of God are so intertwined at this point that the travel between them, the coming and the going, essentially is free and unquestioned. I said when we looked at Gideon that if the last time you looked at Gideon was in Sunday school, you were probably going to be in for a bit of a shock. The same is true for this one. If you're stepping into tonight with Samson as a hero and someone that you admire and you want to keep it that way, I perhaps advise you to leave now because he doesn't come out at the end of this looking very good at all. We see that Israel looks no different from the culture and community around them. Israel doesn't look any different from the world. And we see in verses 1 to 4, the lady portion beat of our narrative. He sees a woman and driven by his desire, he wants her as a wife. He goes to his father and says, "Father, I've seen a woman down here with the Philistines. I want you to go and get her for me as a wife." And his father does a decent job, sort of remembering everything that's just happened in chapter 13, the angel of the Lord coming to him and his wife saying, "Your son is going to deliver Israel from its enemies." And he says, "Are you sure? Are you sure that God's chosen leader, God's Nazarite, is there not someone in Israel that's okay for you? Is there not someone in our family, right, our clan, or the whole of Israel that you could marry?" Why do you have to go to the uncircumcised and find a wife? And that word is important because it reminds us that this isn't about race. This isn't a racial problem for God here. This is about religion. This is about covenant relationship with God. The circumcised were those that were in relationship with God. They were the disciples of Jesus in our modern era, if you will. The uncircumcised were those that were not. And to boot, they, in Judges, they also did a little bit too much child sacrifice. And so Samson's dad here is saying, are you sure that this is the thing that God is calling us to do? Samson vehemently says, no, this is what I want. But you could kind of think that Samson's dad felt a bit like this guy, right? Obi-Wan Kenobi, after he strikes down Anakin at the end of Revenge of the Sith, he says, you were the chosen one. You were meant to destroy the Philistines, not join them. I kind of get that from Samson's dad here, right? Like, God, what are you doing? But what we hear is that they don't know that this is from God, that God is seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. That means there isn't an occasion to confront them. That means the people of God are so comfortable with the enemies of God that even God can't find an opportunity to confront them in the status quo. And so he takes what Samson has, impulsive, insatiable, lustful desire, and he just goes, okay, I'll give you that. And he directs that thing at the Philistines, knowing that Samson is also violent, angry, vengeful. And we will see God give Samson what he needs for the confrontation to continue to boil over. In this, we see that his parents relent and that Samson is proved to have an unteachable and an impulsive spirit. It reveals that Israel too has an unteachable and impulsive spirit. His parents didn't try that hard. It was his father's right to say, no, you're being silly. I'm the leader of the family. You're not marrying her. But he capitulates. I guess he's gone, maybe God isn't coming through for us after all. Verses 5-9, we see the lion incident. Now, in case you were wondering, this is a lion and the other is a lie-in. Don't mistake them. One is a bit of a restful sleep-in on a Saturday if you don't have small children. The other is a beast of the jungle or savanna or the Middle East in the scripture. Don't know how many lions there are in the Middle East anymore. Maybe some. Anyway, I digress. So we see there's a lion. Now, I find this strange, right? He's traveling with his parents, and then he's attacked by a lion, and they seem to know nothing about it. They must be like way ahead or way behind. Maybe he's dragging his feet. Who knows? But whatever it is, they don't know. And the Spirit of the Lord comes on Samson here, right? God gives Samson what he needs to not be killed so that the confrontation can happen. Right, we assume that if that hadn't happened, the lion might have just eaten Samson. Samson wasn't Hercules in Greek mythology. He wasn't just strong. He was empowered by God at moments to be strong. There's a difference. So the lion is torn apart, and I find this interesting. As he would tear a young goat without the Spirit of the Lord is the inference there. Like, I can't tear a young goat. So Samson's a formidable character without the Spirit of the Lord. With it, he tears lions into pieces, right? And at this point, he has broken his Nazarite vow for the first time in the text. We assume it's happened a lot prior. He doesn't seem like the best example, but we see him break it here. At that point, he should have gone to the temple for touching a dead body and been cleansed. He didn't. He hid it from his parents, probably so they didn't make him go to the temple and be cleansed. And he continues pursuing his lustful desires. Have you ever done that? Have you ever been kind of pursuing something you probably shouldn't be pursuing, and then God kind of confronts you with a young lion, or whatever the kind of metaphysical equivalent of that in your life is, and you go, oh man, that was lucky. I better keep going after that thing. Instead of actually turning to God, I wonder, would the story have been different had Samson turned to God at this point and renewed his vows? He goes down, they must negotiate the marriage of some description, and then we hear sometime later, we hear that a lot in these passages, Samson's going back to marry his wife-to-be, or he's going to get his parents or something like that, but he's traveling alone back through the place he's just killed this lion, and he notices that there's a bunch of bees in it, and they've made some honey, and he decides to have some food. He has a bit of a taste of the honey. He likes that honey. He goes, oh, this is very tasty. I might take some more to my parents. I don't know how he got it to his parents. I don't know if he took some lion with him or if he scooped it out with a stick, but we're not told. But what we are told is he breaks his vow for a second time, touching a dead body, and then he makes his parents unknowingly, spiritually unclean. He allows his defilement and rejection of who God has called him to be to defile and make unclean the people in his community. And we see that in Christian leaders today, don't we? Scandal after scandal, leaving wounds in the communities that they have led. And I don't need to talk about them and name them off and all of that, because we know them. We've heard enough of those kinds of scandals. But spiritual authority exists. Samson has it. And here we get a picture of him not respecting and honoring. When the church looks like the world, this happens more and more and more. Verses 10 to 20 give us our final beat of chapter 14, and we see the riddle. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to use the word labyrinth, but there's actually not, I couldn't find a good picture for riddle, so I've just decided to show you a picture of the 1986 film The Labyrinth with David Bowie. Now, and weirdly, there's some similarities. Look, Sarah is a way better hero than Samson. If you haven't seen this film, go and watch it. It's got nothing to do with the text. But Sarah's a way better hero and role model than Samson. Bowie's a much better villain than the Philistines are. The cons are there isn't much biblical truth, if any, in it. And it's weirdly still about child sacrifice. So we see Samson now break his vow for a third time, and he participates in a feast. Now, this isn't a feast that we see outlined in the law, in Deuteronomy or Numbers. This is a feast of the Philistines, right? This isn't the way that the people of God are told to get married. This is the way that the Philistines get married, or the weird mashup of culture that has happened has just decided marriage is going to happen. It's a drinking feast. They're all getting very drunk. It's, I guess, maybe the modern equivalent of a like really cliched bucks party. And so he decides to throw this party. The community of the Philistines give him 30 companions to drink and be merry with, I suppose. And then he decides to give them this riddle. Now, gambling isn't the best use of our resources, and it's certainly not becoming of a spiritual leader. But Samson here bets his companions, those that he's, I guess, supposed to be in merriment and journeying toward his wedding with. He gives them a riddle that really they can't win. It's a really bizarre riddle. If we hadn't just read what we'd just read, we wouldn't get it. It's just odd. Out of the eater, something, out of the eater, something to eat, out of the strong, something sweet. Maybe you think you could have got it, but I just think it's really, really strange. 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. And it's about his lion. something that only he knows about. He's hidden it thus far. And in verses 14 to 17, we see that no one can get it. It's impossible. And it's probably set up to be impossible. It's the God's set apart here is taking advantage of a community that he is being invited into. So that community threatens his wife, a part of their own community. And we see here that the Philistines, their heart is violent. It's a culture of one-upmanship. It's aggressive, and it won't be beaten by this Israelite. And she throws herself at her husband and begs him to tell her the riddle. Now, I've seen a lot of awful things written in commentaries about like her in this moment, and I think we do a pretty bad job of kind of highlighting what's going on for her, right? This is a woman who is being married off to a thug and a brute, someone who, is in the community of the enemies of God, absolutely, but has no right to her own life. She's now being threatened by the very community that she might seek safety from should her marriage turn sour. And her husband at this point, I have to take a detour, never asks what's wrong, never consoles her. There is no love here. The people of God are told to get married like this. A man will leave his father and mother and be married to his wife, and they will become one flesh. There is no one flesh here. This is all about Samson's impulsive desires. And ultimately, because he's infatuated with her or because he's just sick of her talking, he tells. He tells her the riddle without ever seeking why her distress is so apparent, without ever asking what he could do to perhaps help her. And so Samson loses the bet. He mocks his wife in the end of the scene. And then the Spirit of the Lord comes on him again and gives a weapon to the vengefulness, the bitterness, and the evil that's already in Samson's heart. And so Samson uses the gifts of God then to pay his debts. Not to deliver Israel from the Philistines, but to pay his debt. And that's what we see happening here. God goes, Samson, I know that you are vengeful and angry and impulsive and violent. And so I guess I'm just going to empower you and point you at my enemies. And Samson does exactly as we could expect. He goes to another Philistine town, kills 30 people, takes their clothes, gets some garments and pays his debts, and then rage quits the wedding. He flips the table and he's done. He's like, I'm out of here. I've had enough of this. And he leaves. He leaves his wife there. I reiterate, there is no one flesh here. She's now has even less kind of rights in the community that she is a part of. She's even more alienated. She can't be married properly to anyone else, so she's just given now to one of the companions. And then chapter 15, we just see this like series of cascading conflicts. Samson cools down, I suppose, but he's still bitter and rejected. This guy's got some serious rejection sensitivity going on. He doesn't like to lose. And when he finds out that his wife has been given away, his thought is, I need to help her. I need to get her out of there. I need to like actually honor the commitment I made to her. And it's not, well, maybe I should get on now with the whole delivering of Israel thing. It's no, now I'm going to take my vengeance on the Philistines. And that's what he does. He catches 300 innocent foxes ties their tails together, sets them on fire, and lets them loose in the fields and the vineyards and the barns. That's pretty awful. Not the Bible's best environmentalist. And then the Philistines say, what is going on here? Who did this? Find out it was Samson. And so then they go and make good on the promise to burn his wife and her father and house. And that's what they do. The Philistines burn the Philistine woman and her father. Samson finds out about this and says, oh, now I'll really get my revenge on you. Not I'll avenge her, mind you, which might maybe just be admirable, but now I'm going to get my revenge on you. And he just starts killing Philistines indiscriminately. And that's what he does. And then he goes to sleep in a cave. Now, in that whole time, we're not told that the Spirit of the Lord comes on him again, but we assume that that's probably what's happening. The Spirit of the Lord came on him at the end of the previous chapter. Now, it either stayed or it came and went as he needed it. We don't know how long that period of time is. It could have been 10 years. It could have been 5 years. It could have been a week and a half. We don't know. But God is sustaining Samson in his rage, in order to confront the Philistines and their gods and divorce his people from their enemies. And then the weirdest thing happens. The Philistines, unsurprisingly, march, they mobilize against Samson where he is. He's in a place called Ekron, which you might have seen it on the map, just to the left of Timnah there. Left? It's my left. I don't know if it's... I'm not sure. But he's in Ekron, in a little cave, and he's hiding. No, he's not actually. He's not even hiding. He's just asleep. And then the Philistines roll out, and they camp near this place. And Judah, so like, this is like the tribe of Jesus, right? This is the tribe that David will come from. This is like, these are the guys that when it's bad, you can count on them to not be bad. They are so comfortable with the cultural capitulation, with the people of God being sold out to the spirit of the world, that they say, don't you know, Samson, that the Philistines are the rulers over us? Like, can't you just relax? We've got it pretty good, man. Like, we're not fighting. We're not at war. Like, maybe we've got these cool inventions now. Forget about this whole delivering Israel business or even this vengeance business. And they're willing to hand their judge over to their enemies. And so Samson says, all right, well, fine, but just don't kill me yourself. And they say, no, we won't. We'll just hand you over. So they tie him up. And then the Spirit of the Lord comes on him, and with the jawbone of a donkey, he dispatches 3,000 Philistines. That's sermon for he kills 3,000 Philistines. Now that's pretty wild, right? It's pretty bloody. It's pretty gory. And you can imagine that that is pretty exhausting for Samson as well. Sure, he's strong, but I imagine he's still human, right? He's not Jesus. He's not Hercules, like I said, from Greek mythology. He just is a human that God makes strong for a bit so that he can confront his enemies. So he's now exhausted, and he prays for the first time in the narrative, perhaps in his life. And he cries out to God, God, you've given your servant this great victory. Do I have to now die of thirst and be handed over to the uncircumcised? And even in the midst of Samson's petulance, his irreverence, and his selfish, pretty pathetic prayer, God responds. But I think that that prayer reveals something else about Samson. Something that up until now we might have been able to give him the benefit of the doubt on. You see, Samson, this is the first time he uses any kind of covenant language. This is the first time he uses the word Lord. It's the first time he uses the word uncircumcised. It's the first time he uses the word servant. You see, Samson knows who he is supposed to be. He just doesn't want to be it. Samson isn't naive to who God has called him to be. His parents raised him to be a Nazarite of God. He knows, at least in part, that the way he is living his life is not the way he's called to live it. And yet he does it anyway, not from naivety, but from rebellion. He knows that he is the people of God. He knows that he has a place in that people as a leader, and he chooses to reject it. But God answers his prayers anyway. Interestingly, God doesn't speak to him, only gives him water. I think this water here is a picture of Jesus. We're told that he drinks the water and his strength returns. If that doesn't sound like the eternal living water, I don't know what does. This is a picture of Jesus, the angel of the Lord, Emmanueling, being with his people before he was ever flesh. Samson knows he has a place with his people, and he rejects it. St. Hilary's, do you know that you have a place in the kingdom of God, in the community of the church, and in relationship with Jesus? Do you know that you have a God-given identity? Or are you rejecting it, rebelling against it, and choosing instead to capitulate to the world around us? Israel had not only worshipped the idols and the gods of the Philistines, but they became like the Philistines. Samson was angry and violent and vengeful, but that is not how the people of God fight. And whilst our capitulation isn't as obvious, the temptation for us to sacrifice the ways of God for our culture is there. Especially when we started this whole thing understanding that conflict is part of our message. That our message will bring us into conflict with the evil in the world. But it will do it in a way that highlights the radical love, the holy living, and the surrender to Jesus that our Lord has modeled for us. Our war is not flesh and blood, but it's spiritual. And we engage it with spiritual resources through prayer, through intercession, and through walking in the opposite spirit. To put that in plain speak, instead of buying into the angry, violent, and vengeful narrative of our day, we walk in peace, in love, and with the ultimate goal to reconcile relationship to ourselves and to Jesus. The message of the gospel should bring us into conflict with a world that is fractured and contentious, a world that is not surrendered to Jesus. And if you're curious about how to start asking God, where in my life have I replaced your will and your way for my own or for the world's, an interesting place to look is how you feel about either of these two men. Because never before in my 10 years as a disciple have I ever experienced a time where the perception of the church, particularly online, is more divided, is more vitriolic, and is more politicized. How you feel about these two men might reveal where you've replaced the way of God with the way of the world. Tim Keller, when he's talking about the things that we can do to supplant what God would call us to, talking about the politicized church, if you will, identifies these things, that conservative churches will hold up authority and the nuclear family, their own race and traditional culture. I can't see the other one up there. And liberal churches will almost do the opposite. They'll let go of personal responsibility and absolute truths. I can't see them. No, never mind. Well, you can see it. You know, I know. And you can see there that if the church did its job, if it preached morality and judgment and justice and mercy and love, then it would bring it into conflict with the world. And Jesus did all of that. And you know, it's really funny. I was praying and thinking about which one of these we might be. But really curiously, I'm not sure how we do it. We kind of do it all sometimes. We kind of run the gamut on it. It's like rather than a spectrum, we're kind of on that whirlpool. I think we can be guilty of all of these sometimes in different areas of our lives.